or in Christian times, the glorification of incest mixed with adultery and a betrayal of the most fundamental values of hospitality.
So Wagner has been being misunderstood for quite some time then. Patrick, I'd just like you to reach down to the table between us and pick up this exquisite book, which is a hardback from 1877, which you've brought along. It says on the front, Wagner Festival, Royal Albert Hall, May 1877. This is a programme of Wagner himself conducting a massive Wagner Festival right across the road at the Royal Albert Hall. So he has stood where Daniel Barenboim stands tonight and for the rest of this ring cycle. What was this event?
Yeah, well, it was Wagner trying to raise money because, of course, in 1876 at Bayreuth, I mean, they ran out of money, and that was one reason why they couldn't repeat the festival, apart from all the terrible things that went wrong with the production. But fundamentally, it was financial, and they were completely broke, even with help from King Ludwig. So Wagner comes to the Albert Hall here, May 1877, and conducts, gosh, yes, bleeding chunks of himself. And one of those was indeed the very first act of Walküre, which you can see here together with the wonderful Victorian translations.
What's interesting in there is, of course, that there are notations of some of the leitmotifs. And Elaine, we were talking about this in yesterday's event about how much you need to know the leitmotifs before you go in. Do you think it's necessary to have mugged up on your leitmotifs and know the tunes to listen out for before you get there? Or does Wagner do the work for you and introduce you to them as he needs to?
Yeah. You know, Debussy made this wisecrack about the characters showing their visiting card whenever they walked onto the stage. That was what he said, you know, the leitmotifs were like. But they're much subtler than that. They serve many different purposes. You don't need to know what they are. You will, after a few hearings, get the idea anyway. And the interesting thing about them is that they serve as this wonderful subtext. It's going on all the time, and it's having some effect on your brain. You know, you are remembering. You sort of think, I've heard that before. And you're gradually making these connections. It's what creates, I think, some of the huge fascination of the ring, that there is this enormous tapestry of themes. Some people spend their entire life, you know, lying on the floor with all the scores open, sort of notating exactly what the themes are and when they come and all the rest of it. And it can be a real train spotter's delight. But it doesn't matter. There are certain very clear and very obvious ones that you can very easily spot, and you think, ha-ha, there's the sword, for instance.
Well, speaking of the sword, we've got a recording of it. Let's just have a listen to the theme of the sword.
Was Geist tut hell im Gewimmerschein, welch einst der Wald nicht aus der Esche stand. Des blinden Auge leuchtet ein Blitz, lustig lacht da der Blick.
So the sword itself is that sort of heraldic.
But you're talking about, you know, leitmotifs, because the call them tunes, call them what you like, call them phrases, but they tell you things that are not actually physically happening on the stage. They're telling you something of the backstory. For example, you will hear Wotan's theme sort of rumbling away somewhere, because of course it was Wotan himself who planted this sword in the tree in order that his son should find it. And we don't know that it was him, but the music will tell us that it was him. And I think it was one of the very earliest prose drafts. Wagner actually intended Wotan to be present, sort of lurking about in the back of the hut, and actually staying right through to the end in order to witness the incest and hopefully the birth of the new free hero.
There's one more leitmotif I'd like to listen to, which is the so-called redemption theme. Patrick, what does this theme mean?
Well, the redemption through love theme is first announced when Brunhilde announces to Sieglinde, who has survived the murder of her brother and lover, and Brunhilde announces to her that she is to bear a son who will be the Siegfried. And she bursts out, Sieglinde, in this most wonderful, wonderful soaring theme. And what's important is that this actually is the theme with which the whole opera ends at the end of Götterdämmerung, suggesting that it goes right, it carries right forward, and you hear little echoes and intimations of it on the way, but the theme finds its fulfillment right at the end of Götterdämmerung. One needs a lot of patience for the Ring. But also the Ring is great because the stories keep being told over and over again. People keep recapitulating what's gone on before.
Well, let's hear that redemption theme as it appears in Valkyra, which we'll hear tonight. I'm going to confess something, which is that's the kind of tune I've been waiting for. And actually, I found Rheingold rather difficult because a great deal of it was exposition, and it wasn't these great, you know, overarching themes and great, you know, outpourings of romantic music that I was rather waiting for, that I expect we're going to hear more of tonight. The other thing that really struck me yesterday as I was listening through, Elaine, you described the orchestra being this amazing, I suppose it tells you everything you need to know, really. And it's wonderful having it spread out on the stage of the Albert Hall and being able to listen to those orchestral interludes. But while they were happening, reading the libretto and reading Wagner's own stage directions, which are absolutely bonkers, Patrick. I mean, they're like the ravings of a lunatic. And they struck me also as being very, very close to terrible Amdram dry ice disaster. What did they actually look like on stage in Wagner's first Bayreuth productions? Because now, of course, you know, we live in a world of CGI. We can imagine things being terribly slick, but can't possibly have been in those days.
The stage instructions, I think you have to remember that Wagner's trying to create, is creating, an entirely new kind of theatre. He is a great theatre revolutionary, not just in writing The Ring, but his whole ideas about the relationship of music and staging, the intensity of acting. Wagner himself always chose to coach the singers, to be the director of the singers whom he wanted to move wonderfully. But as to these detailed stage instructions, setting the thing in mountain gorges and deep caves and goodness knows what else, and describing rainbow bridges, partly this was actually to defend himself against the usual practices of the theatres in the early 19th century. The idea of special scenery, and that scenery and production would be linked to a particular opera, was extremely unusual. Basically, opera houses had huge sets of, you know, huts, mountain landscape, river landscape, interior, and so on and so on. And when the opera was received from the composer, they just said, ah, yes, well, we can reuse the hut from William Tell, and we'll take the forest from Der Freischütz. And so Wagner is really protecting himself. It was part of this awful thing, this terrible Gesamtkunstpudding, that he wanted all the elements to work together. And so he wanted to describe in words what he'd actually really already written in music. I don't think these stage instructions, he did his best to realize them, and he did, and they didn't do such a bad job, but technically it was very, very difficult. You know, what do you do about having horses on the stage, and what do you do about a rainbow bridge, and so on. The best advice that he got, really, was to go easy with this. And the only person who gave him that advice was the wonderful guy, we now call him a movement director, Richard Fricker, a little ballet master. And he was hired to choreograph everyone and everything. And there was great problems with the dragon, with Fafner. And Fafner was actually made in Wandsworth. There was a firm in Wandsworth, I think it was called Richard Keane, and they specialised in supplying flora and fauna for operas everywhere. So the dragon was ordered up from Richard Keane in Wandsworth. And most of the bits did arrive, but unfortunately, I think Fricka says something like, the Meister is in despair, the neck still hasn't arrived.
Elaine, where are the dragons for Royal Opera House productions made? Wandsworth too? Or?
Probably not far off, actually. I mean, London being the capital of musicals and a very extravagant theatre set generally, it meant the last Royal Opera House ring was using a lot of very advanced technology of the same kind that you find in the big musicals as well. I mean, it's a lot of very complex engineering goes into trying to create the very things that Wagner wanted. Rheingold is the hardest of them all to do because there are no intervals, and you have to get from the bottom of the Rhine up to Valhalla, down to Nibelheim, back up to... I mean, it's extraordinarily difficult. It's a real feat, Rheingold.
Can I just interrupt? Because going back to this, you know, the bit of the shambles that the staging at Bayreuth was, and I promised Sarah that I'd tell her, I said, how did they disguise these scene changes? What they did at Bayreuth was steam. There was no dry ice. Outside the theatre were two large locomotive boilers that were fired up, and there was a sort of steam curtain. All the clouds and vapours were steam, and they were so for about 20 years or so at Bayreuth. You can see actual pictures. Steam it was. And, of course, the poor people in the pit were complaining that it put their instruments out of tune. Terrible problems with steam. Brunhilde was surrounded when she's put to sleep, the couch ringed by flame, if you like, and they were spurts of steam with some sort of red put into them.
I suppose steam is rather better for the voice than dry ice is, so maybe the singers were pleased with that. What about the audience at the first production of the whole of The Ring, and particularly Walküre? What do you get a sense Wagner wanted them to be experiencing in this opera?
Everything, the whole thing. He was a sort of monster. I mean, he wanted people like Nietzsche rightly complained. You know, most opera houses, you know, you went there, the lights were up in the audience, you sat, you chatted to your friends, you had a drink, and so on and so on. And Wagner said, that's not good enough. His supreme egoism, I mean, entirely justified, probably, was he wanted total attention upon himself. And although actually the totally darkened auditorium was probably actually more a mistake than actually was intended, but it was kept. And the idea of hiding the orchestra under the stage, he wanted the theatre that he had on that stage, it was like the cinema, and he wanted a total illusion. And most people did enjoy it. They took it for granted. They didn't expect that productions would be different, and if the composer said that was what it wanted, that was okay. They were glad for the various miracles. They put up with things like swimming machines and things being moved around on the stage and dragons without necks and things. But for most of the audience, it was a musical experience. It was the music that was so amazing.
And they had to wait a long time for it as well, because Walküre was composed in 1854. It was first performed in 1870. And that was before Bayreuth, because it was seen, of course, the first time as part of the cycle in 76. But Ludwig, who had paid lots and lots of money for Wagner to create The Ring, finally insisted on having a preview of both Rheingold and Walküre. So those were performed before the full Ring cycles. But 1854 to 1870, all those years before he actually got to see Walküre. Terribly long time to wait for, you know. I'm sure he was delighted that there was an audience, that there was, you know, the piece was actually being performed finally.
As we were talking the other day about Bayreuth and about the Gesamtkunstwerk and his idea that, you know, of the full staging of everything, and also fascinating to, you know, hear that the Bayreuth orchestra is kind of snuck away underneath everything else, so you don't see the orchestra at all. Tonight we are hearing it without any of the staging, but in the hall of the Albert Hall with just the orchestra. So the score is essentially laid bare, kind of reassuring, you know, to have this programme here, to know that Wagner conducted it himself in the Albert Hall and was clearly quite happy with that, at least when he needed to raise some money. Elaine, are you a kind of lover of concert performances of opera? Do you think they're a good way of getting into this?
There's certainly a good way of getting into it, but there is nothing like being a ring collector. I mean, once you start on seeing ring productions, then you certainly, you know, you get the bug. And there are so many different ways of interpreting the rings. It has such riches, such depths, that you really do want to see it. However it's realised, and there are so many different interpretations that you can see. But finally, of course, it is a great work of music. He was a great musician. He was also a great writer. It's a very good plot. It took him 4 years to write the books. And, you know, they are really masterpieces in themselves. But it is a fantastic musical work. And to have the orchestra centre stage. You know, it's become a thing to do at the end of a ring cycle. We did it at Covent Garden, to bring the orchestra up onto the stage for a final curtain call at the end of it, you know, so that you can see. And it's such a tribute to Wagner because, as we say, that this great narrator in the pit is such a vital part of the whole experience of the ring.
But it doesn't just tell the story. It really does describe. I think from many producers, many directors and designers' point of view, the score is almost over-specific. It is very mimetic. You know, all those anvils and things, the music that climbs up when a mountain is climbed and so on. Horses in the Ride of the Valkyries. Really, you jolly well should be able to imagine the production perfectly from the music and make your own production in your head. Lots of modern productions drive people mad because they actually are very, very critical, very aggressive, very interrogative of Wagner, sometimes rather scorning him, very concerned. But I think we've long since won that battle, and Wagner himself recognised that he hadn't solved the problems, and that if the ring was any good at all, it would actually subject itself or would thrive on different interpretations. That's the world we're in, but ultimately, make your own production in your own head, the theatre of your imagination.
Off we go for the second part of Die Walküre. Do join me again for Friday in the first interval of Siegfried for the next instalment of the journey. Thanks again to Elaine Padmore and Patrick Carnegie for joining us today.
Sarah Moore Peach at the Royal College of Music. And so to Act Two of Die Walküre, as Sarah was saying, here at the Proms. In the first scene of Act Two, we'll meet maybe the most famous character in the whole Ring Cycle, Brunhilde, Wotan's daughter, the Valkyrie the whole opera is named after, whom he fathered with Erda after he went off to seduce the Earth Goddess sometime between the end of Das Rheingold last night and the beginning of Die Walküre. It was a busy evening for Wotan and indeed for Erda. It's a role sung tonight and on Friday in Siegfried and in Sunday's Götterdämmerung by one of the world's greatest Wagnerian performers. Tonight's Brunhilde, Swedish soprano Nina Stemmer.
Brunhilde is one of the most difficult roles a soprano could ever sing. I think it's long, it's high, it's low, it's dramatic. It should have some lyric moments as well. In the Valkyrie, for instance, you start out with this highly dramatic hunting call, the Hoyotohos, yeah, which is a show-off, kind of, should also sound. That's where I compare Brunhilde with Pippi Longstocking. She has not encountered any problems in her life. She is sort of a godly status. And after that, it goes downhill most of the time. And then in the next scene in the Valkyrie, she needs to be a contralto, more or less. Okay, there's a little bit with Wotan, but when she's telling Sigmund that he has to go and die, she's a contralto. It's very, very low, and it's unusual for a soprano to go that low. But Wagner wrote it, and I think it gives wonderful colors to the character as well, that he dared to do that. I feel very feminine in a way when I go down in that register.
Nina Stemmer, who we're going to hear right now at the start of the second act of Die Walküre. Brünnhilde is with her father, Wotan, who tells her to keep Siegmund safe in the coming battle with Hunding. No dice, says the goddess of wedlock, Fricka, Wotan's wife. You've created an incestuous pair of adulterers in Siegmund and Sieglinde. Created? Well, that's because Wotan fathered the twins too. Velsa was, in fact, Wotan in human camouflage. So Wotan has to agree to Fricka's demand. Siegmund must die. In the next scene of Act Two, alone with Brünnhilde, Wotan delivers a long monologue telling the whole story of the ring so far from his perspective. He needs a free hero to defeat Fafnir, the giant who's now disguised as a dragon guarding the gold and the ring. Wotan can't create this hero himself. This hero has to be free of his influence, so Siegmund just won't do. But when Brünnhilde tells Siegmund his fate in the next scene, that he is to follow her to Valhalla as a fallen, that's to say, dead hero, Siegmund refuses. He threatens instead to kill Sieglinde and himself rather than accept this destiny. Brünnhilde, overwhelmed by the intensity of his love for Sieglinde, relents. It may go completely against their father's order to her, but she will save him after all. The final scene of the second act is the fight, Siegmund's fight with Hunding. Siegmund, with the sword, Notung, and with Brünnhilde's blessing, has the upper hand until Wotan appears and shatters the sword. Now defenseless, Hunding kills Siegmund. Brünnhilde rides off with Sieglinde and the fragments of the sword, Notung, and Wotan kills Hunding in fury and goes off in pursuit of his disobedient Valkyrie daughter. The voices you'll hear in Act Two of Die Walküre here at the Proms, Nina Stemmer sings Brünnhilde and Bryn Terwel is Wotan. Ekaterina Gubanova is his wife Fricka and Erik Halfvorsen sings Hunding. Siegmund and Sieglinde, the pair of incestuous and adulterous lovers, are Simon O'Neill and Anya Kamper. One of the things about hearing The Ring as a concert performance, this for the first time in a single season in Proms history, and also the Staatskapelle Berlin making their debut in this ring cycle at the Proms, astonishing when you think about it, is the way that the concert experience, and I'm sure at home too, becomes theatre. Daniel Barenboim was saying after the last night's performance of Das Rheingold that one of the problems about putting The Ring on stage is that you have to choose. You either do a naturalistic production with gods, monsters, rainbow bridges and that kind of thing, or you go for symbolism, for meaning, for some kind of interpretation of The Ring. But of course, you don't have to do that here in the Royal Albert Hall. Instead, Wagner's extraordinary fusion of music and symbol, the way that everything you hear in The Ring cycle is both the glorious sounds of this orchestra in front of me, and also meaning, also symbol, the leitmotifs, the sword motif, the Valhalla motif idea. Music is meaning in Wagner all the time. The stage director tonight is Justin Way, who's responsible for coordinating all of the entrances and exits that the characters make. And it really, that's one aspect of the way that the Albert Hall is turned into a theatre throughout these performances. Last night for Das Rheingold and tonight for Die Walküre. The Royal Albert Hall waits expectantly after that astonishing crescendo at the end of Act One. Really, the whole of Act One, I think, in that performance was shaped as a single arc from the storm at the beginning to the radiance of Siegmund and Sieglinde's union as the sword Notung was pulled from the ash tree at the end of the first act. And here comes Daniel Barenboim. See, they're cheering already for Act Two of Die Walküre. Before then, though, Daniel Barenboim brings the orchestra of the Staatskapelle Berlin to accept this huge applause and applauds them himself as well he might. Let's hear then the second and most involved act of Die Walküre by Richard Wagner.
bald entbrennt brünstiger Streit. Brünnhilde stürme zum Kampf, dem Wels und Kiesel sie sieg. Und ihn wähle sich, wem gehört, nach Fallhall taugt mir nicht. Drum rüst ich und rasch, Reiter zur Wahl.
Ich glaube! Ach, Mutter, nicht so, dass mit Zwang ich halte, was dir nicht haftet. Denn wo kühne Kräfte sich regen, da rat ich offen zum Krieg. Was von selbst sich fügt, sei zuvor auch noch nie es geschehen. Dass jene sich lieben, leuchtet dir hell, drum höre redlichen Rat, soll süßer Lust einen Sieben dir lachend der Liebe Siegmunds und Sieglindes Bund.
So ist sie
Die Bande, die sollst du bewundern.
Er ist doch ein Gefühl.
hoffest du, wollt ich dich lehren, was nie du erkennen kannst, wie nicht ertagte die Tat. Stets gewohnt es nur magst du verstehen, doch was noch nie sich traf, danach trachtet den Sinn. Eines höre, Mut tut ein Held, der ledig göttlichen Schutzes sich löse vom Göttergesetz. So nur taugt er zu wirken die Tat, die wie Not sie den Göttern, den Gott. Doch zu wirken verwehrt.
Stößest du das Schwert in den Stab, du verhältst es dir. Thank you. dich schloss der Streit, lachte Fricka dem Lose.
Verlauten lös ich dann nicht meines Willens haltenden Hass.
Zu Wut eines Willen sprichst du, sagst du mir, was
thank you.
junge Liebe Lust mir verblich, verlangte nach Macht mein Mut. Von jeher Wünsche Wüten gejagt, gewann ich mir die Welt. Unwissend trugvoll, untreue übt ich, band durch Verträge, was Unheil barg. Listig verlockte mich Loge, der schweifend nun verschwand. Von der Liebe doch mocht ich nicht lassen, in der Nacht verlangt ich nach Minne. Die Nacht gebar, der Bammer Nebel um Albrecht brach ihren Bund. Er fluchte der Lieb und gewann durch den Fluch des reines glänzendes Gold und mit ihm maßlose Macht. Den Ring, den er schuf, entriss ich ihm listig, doch nicht dem Rhein gab ich ihm zurück, mit ihm bezahlt ich Walhalls Zinnen, der Burg, die Riesen mir bauten, aus der ich der Welt ungewohnt. Die alles weiß, was einsten war, er da, die weiliche weiseste Wala, riet mir ab von dem Ring, warnte vor ewigem Ende. Von dem Ende wollt ich mehr noch wissen, doch schweigend entschwand mir das Weib, da verlor ich den leichten Mut. Zu wissen begehrt ist ihm dort, in den Schoß der Welt spann ich mich hinab, mit Liebeszauber zwang ich die Mala, stört ihr das Wissen stolz, was ihr Reden nun mir spann. Die Männer, denen den Mut mir gewährt, die nun trübe Verträge, trübende Bande, zu blinden Gehorsam wir uns gebunden. Des Haltens durch Sturm und Streiken und Stacheln, ihre Kraft reizen zu rauem Krieg, das kühne Kämpfe scharen, ich sammle in Walhalls Saal. Es wohl, wes mich die Wahl an.
durch Alberichs Heer droht uns das Ende. Mit neidischem Grimm droht mir der Nebel um. Doch scheu ich nun nicht seine nächtigen Scharen, meine Helden schöpfen mir sie. Neidisch des Ringes Runen zu aller Edlen endlose Schmach. Der Heldenmut entwendet mir, die Kühnen selber zwäng zum Kampf, mit ihrer Kraft bekriegt mich. Sorgen sann ich nun selbst, den Ring dem Feind zu entreißen. Ich einst mit verfluchtem Gold den Fleiß verdammt. Waffner hütet den Hort, um den den Bruder gefällt. Ihm müsst ich den Reif entringen, den selbst als Zoll ich ihm zahlte. Doch mit dem ich vertrug, ihn darf ich nicht treffen. Machtlos vor ihm erlägt ein Mut. Das sind die Bande, die mich binden. Wer durch Verträge schwer, den Verträgen bin ich nun Knecht. Was ich nicht warf. Ein Held, dem helfend ich mich neigte, der fremd dem Gott frei seine Gunst, unbewusst, ohne Geheiß, aus eigener Not, mit der eigenen Wehr, schiffe die Tat. Wünscht sie auch einzig mein Wunsch. Der entgegen dem Gott für mich fürchte, den freundlichen Feind, wie fände ich ihn, wie schlief ich den Freier, den ich schirm, der im eigenen Trotze der Trauteste mir. Wie macht ich den Arm, der nicht mehr echt und aus sich wird, was ich nur will? Oh Gott, wie verdammt, was ich erwirke, das andere, das ich ersehne, das andere ersehe ich nicht. Denn selbst muss der Freie sich schaffen.
Yeah. letzter König hinauf gegen der Götter Rache. Schützt ihn nun einzig das Schwert, das eines Gottes Gunst ihm beschied. Oh, was ich listig selbst mich belügen, so leicht ja entfrug mir Fricka den Trug. Zu tiefster Scham durchschaute sie mich. Ihren Willen muss ich gewähren.
So nimmst du von sich und dem Sieg.
Ich verirrte Albrecht Ring, gierig hielt das Wort. Des wilden Wortes der Waler. Wenn der liebe finstre Feind zürnend zeugt einen Sohn, der sel'gen Ende säumt dann nicht. Vernahm ich die Mär, dass ein Weib der Zwerg bewältigt, des Wunst wollt der Zwang, des Hasses verrocht, liegt eine Frau, des Leides Kraft, kreist ihr im Schoß, das Wunder der Mann, erlang ich mir nicht. Musik. bis zum Herr. Was frommt an ihrer eigener Wille? Einen Freien kann ich nicht wollen, für Frekas Knechte kämpfen unter.
Wie weißt du recht das Wort? Du willst sie, dir zu lieb, ich weiß es, schätze ihn.
Fällen sollst du Sieg und für Hunding erfechten den Sieg. Bitte dich wohl und halte dich stark, all deine Quälheit entbete im Kampf. Ein Siegschwert schwingt Sieg und schwer nicht fällt er dir feig. Dass zum Schimpf der eigenen Geschöpfe ich ward, kennst du, kennt meinen Zorn. Verzahlt dein Mut, wenn jeder Mann auf dich spürt. In meinem Busen berg ich den Grimm, der in Graul und Wurst wirft eine Welt. Lust mir gelacht, er lebt in der Trümpf, blaue Schiff in sein Trotz. Drum rat ich dir, reize mich nicht, besorge, was ich befall, Sieg und Fall. Seit der Walküre weg.
Stein, sprachlos schweigend, sprangst du dahin, kein Ruf hielt dich fast.
Thank you. Thank you. Wahrlich mir nicht. Thank you. Speer!
A world and the gods in chaos, murder and mayhem at the end of the second act of Wagner's Die Walküre at the Proms. Siegmund and Hunding dead, the disobedient Brunhilde being pursued by her furious father, the leader of the gods, Wotan. Total turmoil. Daniel Barenboim brings the players of the Staatskapelle Berlin to their feet here at the Royal Albert Hall. And what a cast we heard over the last 90 minutes or so. Bryn Terrible sings Wotan, Nina Stemmer is Brunhilde, Yekaterina Gubanova was Fricka, Hunding was Erik Halfvorsen, the twins and lovers Siegmund and Sieglinde was Simon O'Neill and Anya Campen. Well, interval time again here at the Royal Albert Hall before the final act of Die Walküre. Now, before more on the story and before we hear more from Nina Stemmer, Daniel Barenboim and Bryn Terrible, it's time for the Soviet Valkyrie. The historian Philip Bullock investigates the way Wagner's music penetrated the cultural world of the USSR.
Think of the name Sergei Eisenstein, and what comes to mind? Perhaps his black and white films of the 1920s. Strike, Battleship Potemkin, or 10 Days That Shook the World, which celebrated the revolutionary events of 1905 and 1917 that ultimately led to the establishment of Soviet power, successfully fusing Bolshevik propaganda and innovative cinematic techniques. They immediately put Russia at the vanguard of European art at the time. Or perhaps his later films will come to mind, Alexander Nevsky and Ivan the Terrible, in which Eisenstein reached back into medieval Russian history in order to comment on present-day events, as well as making his own ambiguous contribution to the cult of Stalin's rule. Yet for all his fame as a filmmaker, November the 21st, 1940, saw Eisenstein make his debut as an opera director with a production of Wagner's Die Walküre at Moscow's Bolshoi Theatre. This would have struck many as a distinctly unlikely development. After all, Eisenstein had no recent experience of working in the theatre, let alone the opera house, and the plot of Wagner's music drama seems to have little in common with the situations and characters who normally captured his imagination. Yet look a little deeper, and we begin to see a whole host of reasons why Eisenstein was drawn to Die Walküre, some personal, some artistic, some ideological. Wagner has always been a political as well as an artistic figure, and nowhere has this been more true than in Soviet Russia. The impetus behind Eisenstein's staging of Die Walküre was primarily political. Although the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany had been enemies throughout the 1930s, in August 1939, the two countries signed a non-aggression pact that left both sides free to pursue military conquests elsewhere. On the cultural front, the pact led to a sudden burst of interest in German culture in the Soviet Union. German art had not been entirely forbidden in the 1930s, but it had certainly fallen victim to the general atmosphere of patriotism and even xenophobia that marked that decade. Wagner's music in particular was far less frequently performed than before, and his reputation as Hitler's favourite composer didn't help matters either. Now, however, musicians were not just free to perform his works, but were actively encouraged to do so. Conceived in homage to the new alliance between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, Eisenstein's production of Die Walküre drew lavishly on the financial and artistic resources of the Soviet Union's leading opera house, the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow, and its performances were attended by the diplomatic and political elite of the country and widely discussed in the press. Writing around the time of the opera's premiere, Eisenstein explained the artistic vision behind his staging of Die Walküre.
The Wagner who composed The Ring of the Nibelung was the Wagner who is nearest to us, the Wagner who was still inspired by the revolution of 1848, in which he had taken part and which inspired him for many years to come. It was the revolution that gave him the necessary impetus to compose his tetralogy about the curse of gold, and he had in mind not the struggle between men, gods, dragons and dwarves for the possession of the treasure, but the curse of property, which inevitably leads men to fight each other, as well as the egotistical thirst for property, which is at the root of all the evil deeds in myth and in history. A hatred for bourgeois acquisitiveness runs through all of Wagner's writings at all periods of his life. The strongest expression of this hatred, dressed in musical and poetic form, can be found in the tragic fate of Wotan, enslaved by property and condemned to suffer all the curses that flow from it. The final part of the tetralogy, The Twilight of the Gods, symbolizes the collapse of the world of murder and robbery, of legalized lies, of fraud and hypocrisy, the world in which the composer lived. Wagner could not imagine an escape from this cursed ring, from the vicious circle of property, except in the distant future and in a world which must first be cleansed and purified.
In many ways, Eisenstein's views are typical of mainstream Soviet opinion on Wagner in the 1930s. For Soviet critics, Wagner was first and foremost a political radical. He had, after all, been so inspired by the revolutionary spirit that seized Europe in 1848 that he took part in the Dresden uprising the following May. Moreover, his involvement in revolutionary politics was partly encouraged by the Russian anarchist Mikhail Bakunin, alongside whom he had fought at Dresden, and who was even said to have inspired the character of Siegfried, who brings about the destruction of the old order in the Ring. Eisenstein makes much of Wagner's involvement in the revolutionary events of the late 1840s and sees Wagner as a passionate anti-capitalist, reading the Ring cycle as an allegory of the collapse of bourgeois society. Deliberately ignoring the pessimistic and reactionary elements in the composer's works and writings, Eisenstein sees Wagner as a tragic figure, unable to escape the material conditions of the world in which he lived, and condemned to understand that his vision belonged to the distant future and a world which must first be cleansed and purified. Yet for Soviet citizens, that world had now been realised in the form of communism. Unlike Wagner, they were free of the burden of capitalism and of bourgeois culture, and could see the Ring not as a lament for a dying world, but as a prophecy of a new order. Eisenstein's views are a serious attempt to appropriate Wagner's music in the service of Soviet cultural politics, but they don't really account for the artistic interest that Die Walküre held for him. His surviving sketches, as well as memoirs and reviews of the production, reveal that his primary approach to staging Wagner was aesthetic. Bringing all his experience as a filmmaker to his work at the Bolshoi, he achieved effects that might have eluded other directors and came up with scenery that was fully integrated into the action, rather than being merely a backdrop for it. Used to the two-dimensional canvas of the cinema screen, Eisenstein was particularly sensitive to the handling of depth, breadth and height on the operatic stage. Sketches and photographs of Act One show a stage dominated by the ash tree at the centre of Hunding's house, with craggy mountain tops filling the stage from top to bottom and from front to back in Act Two and Three. Eisenstein was equally interested in the way that colour could shape the way in which viewers engage with the action, what he called the play of light and fire. Act One was characterised by the naturalistic use of greens and browns, which gave way to the more transcendent shades of orange, violet and blue as Wotan surrounds Brunhilde with a protective ring of fire at the end of the opera. If such scenes were dependent on Eisenstein's cinematic ability to conceive of opera in terms of its visual effects, then he was just as attuned to its musical aspects. In fact, Eisenstein was acutely aware of the relationship between sound and vision, as he had only just completed work on his first sound film, Alexander Nevsky, whose score by Sergei Prokofiev is as central to its impact as Eisenstein's images. After the signing of the Nazi-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact, Nevsky was banned because of its negative portrayal of the Germans, but Eisenstein clearly carried over many of the lessons he had learnt from it into his work on Die Walküre. Here, however, his ambitions outran him. For The Ride of the Valkyries in Act Three, for instance, he hoped to create an overwhelming sonic and visual impression by having the music played through loudspeakers placed around the auditorium. This turned out to be wholly impracticable, although it's interesting to note that this grandiose spectacle of sound and image would eventually be realised in Francis Ford Coppola's film Apocalypse Now. All in all, however, Eisenstein's production was a remarkable achievement, a piece of total theatre that unified sound and image, audience and performers, art and ideology, in a single overwhelming theatrical event. In his critical writings, as well as in his operas, Wagner had explored a kind of theatre that unified all the arts in a single work, what he referred to as a Gesamtkunstwerk, or total work of art. He had also spoken of the artwork of the future, das Kunstwerk der Zukunft, which would unite poetry, music and gesture in the service of the needs of the people as a whole. Eisenstein's production of Die Walküre sought to prove that the home of these ideas was not Nazi Germany, but Stalin's Soviet Union. And although Wagner could have had no inkling of the revolutionary potential of film as an artistic medium, he would surely have been impressed by Eisenstein's ability to realise his theatrical ambitions in the opera house. For a moment, it looked as though Wagner's works would make a triumphant return to Soviet opera houses, and Eisenstein began to make plans for productions of the other three operas in the Ring cycle. Such hopes were dashed, however, when Hitler unexpectedly invaded in June 1941. Die Walküre had run for just 6 performances, and it wouldn't be until after the collapse of the Soviet Union that Wagner would finally return to Russian opera houses. But if we look backwards rather than forwards, we can see that Eisenstein's production of Die Walküre was more than just an ideologically motivated piece of historical propaganda, and more than just an interesting episode in the life of the Soviet Union's leading filmmaker. It was also the culmination of nearly a century of Russian interest in Wagner. Although Wagner had conducted a successful series of concerts in St. Petersburg and Moscow in 1863, his music met with considerable disdain and misunderstanding for much of the rest of the century. The first of his operas to be staged in Russia was Lohengrin, which was finally performed in St. Petersburg in 1868, after a number of years in which the government had banned it. It would then be more than 20 more years before a visiting troupe gave the first complete performance of The Ring in 1889, and it wasn't until 1900 that a Russian theatre began to stage the cycle. The nationalist composers were overtly hostile to Wagner's influence, and Tchaikovsky, who had attended the opening of the Bayreuth Festival, was also sceptical. However, perhaps the most negative reaction to Wagner's music was written not by a musician, but by the novelist Lev Tolstoy, whose 1897 treatise, What is Art?, includes the following satirical account of a performance of Siegfried.
When I arrived, the enormous theatre was already filled from top to bottom. There were grand dukes, and the flower of the aristocracy, of the merchant class, and of the middle-class official public. Most of them held a libretto, trying to fathom its meaning. Musicians, some of them elderly, grey-haired men, followed the music score in hand. Evidently, the performance of this work was an event of some importance. I was rather late, but I was told that the short prelude with which the act begins was of little importance, and that it did not matter having missed it. When I arrived, an actor sat on the stage amid decorations intended to represent a cave, and before something which was meant to represent a blacksmith's forge. He was dressed in tights, with a cloak made of skins, wore a wig and an artificial beard, and with white, weak, genteel hands, beat an impossible sword with an unnatural hammer in a way in which no one ever uses a hammer. And at the same time, opening his mouth in a strange way, he sang something incomprehensible. The music of various instruments accompanied the strange sounds which he emitted. From the libretto, one was able to gather that the actor had to represent a powerful gnome who lived in a cave and who was forging a sword for Siegfried, whom he had reared. One could tell he was a gnome by the fact that the actor walked all the time, bending the knees of his tight-covered legs. This gnome, still opening his mouth in the same strange way, long continued to sing or shout.
Yet throughout the first decades of the 20th century, Russian interest in Wagner blossomed into a fully grown cult. As Russian theatres staged his operas more and more frequently, local singers began to add his work to their repertoire, and often with notable success. Such was the fame of the tenor Ivan Yershov, for instance, that he was invited by Cosima Wagner to sing at Bayreuth, although he declined the opportunity, as he would have had to relearn his part in German.
Ясно блещет мой меч, вот он
If Wagner transformed Russian musical culture, he also had a profound influence on the country's intellectual and artistic life too. For some, his importance was primarily aesthetic. Encountering his works led to a transformation in their own work. Writing about the history of the Ballet Russe, for instance, the artist Alexandre Benoit highlighted the huge importance of Wagner's ideas for the artists involved.
The ballet is one of the most consistent and complete expressions of the idea of Gesamtkunstwerk, the idea for which our circle was ready to give its soul. It was no accident that what was afterwards known as the Ballet Russe was originally conceived not by professionals of the dance, but by a circle of artists, linked together by the idea of art as an entity. Everything followed from the common desire of several painters and musicians to see the fulfillment of the theatrical dreams that haunted them.
For others, his influence was spiritual, religious even. The symbolist poet Vyacheslav Ivanov interpreted Wagner's operas as grandiose collective acts in which the audience was morally transformed by participation in the drama as it was enacted on the stage.
Wagner's music dramas were conceived as universal festive acts. The assembled voice of humanity is hidden in the orchestra's harmonies from the mighty, stormy, sonorous sea of instrumental music in which, according to the composer's conception, the will of the world seeks its expression. The colourful mirage of the state emerges like the golden cloud of a prophetic dream, like a magic mirror, revealing life in its hidden essence as it presents itself to clairvoyant contemplation. In the sonorities of the wordless instrumental chorus, according to the composer's ideas, the assembled will of all humanity sounds, and merging with the soul of the symphony, we ourselves summon and create that vision of the transformed human being in the images of the gods and heroes who move before us, as we cast our reflections into some supra-worldly space.
Ivanov's ideas were enthusiastically taken up in the years immediately following the October Revolution, which was perhaps paradoxically a positive influence on Russian Wagner reception. Lenin reversed Nicholas II's ban on performances of Wagner's music on grounds of his German nationality, and figures like Anatoly Lunacharsky, the Commissar for Enlightenment, regularly wrote and lectured on Wagner. The Bolsheviks staged vast public pageants that reenacted the events of the revolution in a way that recalled Wagner's idea on the synthesis of the arts and Ivanov's notion of collective theatre. And the Commissariat of Enlightenment even supported the establishment of a Society for Wagner's Art in Petrograd in 1923. The Society produced chamber versions of Wagner's operas designed for proletarian audiences and students, although unfortunately it folded in 1925 as a result of financial and political pressures. If Wagner led to a revolution in attitude to drama and spectacle, then he was invariably seen as a political radical too. Soviet commentators rarely failed to mention his involvement with the Dresden Uprising, and his works were routinely read as anti-capitalist, anti-bourgeois allegories that were wholly in keeping with Marxist philosophy. A translation of Art and Revolution was one of the very first books published by the Commissariat for Enlightenment in 1918, and for many Bolsheviks, this manifesto was almost as important as Marx and Engels' Communist Manifesto. The belated arrival of Wagner's music in Russia, as well as the crucial role played by his ideas in early Soviet cultural politics, meant that Wagner was much more closely tied up with modernism and the avant-garde than in other countries. The radical theatre director Vsevolod Meyerholt had staged Tristan and Isolde as early as 1909, and the constructivist artist Vladimir Tatlin produced a stunning series of sketches for the Flying Dutchman during the years of the First World War. Little wonder, then, that one of Fyodor Komissarzewski's first productions after the October Revolution was a futurist staging of Lohengrin. Freed from the burden of German national identity, Wagner had become an artistic and political radical, and his works found a ready home in Soviet Russia throughout the 1920s. Even the rise of Hitler didn't affect Wagner's reputation as much as might be thought. 1933 was also the year of the 50th anniversary of Wagner's death, and Soviet periodicals devoted much space to his life, works and theories. If stage productions became rarer, then concert programmes continued to feature extracts and sometimes even whole acts of his music dramas, and his ideas continued to influence Soviet artists too. Dmitri Shostakovich's opera, Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, was originally intended to be the first of a series of four operas dealing with the fates of Russian and Soviet women, a kind of Soviet response to the Ring cycle. And plenty of other operas written in the 1930s can be seen as epic responses to Wagner's original inspiration. Sergei Eisenstein's 1940 production of Die Walküre was, then, a far less anomalous event than might at first appear to be the case. It may have been conditioned by the brief rapprochement between the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany that followed the signing of the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact in August 1939, but it also stands as the high point of Russian and Soviet interest in Wagner's music and ideas, an interest that was as much artistic as it was ideological. The Soviet appropriation of Wagner is one of the stranger episodes in Russian cultural history, but it also suggests that what matters more than an author's intentions is the use to which his or her works can be put by subsequent generations and by different cultures. We're probably more used to the controversy over Wagner's popularity with the Nazis, but the story of Soviet interest in Wagner and of Eisenstein's production of Die Walküre shows a very different ideological context, and one, somewhat ironically, which might even prefigure our own present-day condition. As we struggle with the fallout of the global financial crisis, and wonder whether we are witnessing the death throes of capitalism as we know it, might not Wagner's account of the passing of the old order and his anticipation of something idealistically new have a message for us, here and now? Might this not, after all, be the music of the coming revolution?
The Soviet Valkyrie was presented by Philip Bullock. The readers were Ben Crow and David Seddon, and the producer was Mark Berman. Now, it can't have escaped your attention that yesterday was the hottest day of the year, the day that our Ring cycle here at the Proms, the first complete one ever in a prom season, started. Now, the heroes of the Ring cycle aren't just on stage here at the Royal Albert Hall, they're in the arena too. I can see hundreds of them taking a break, having a seat, having a lie down in I've got to say, the searing humidity of the Royal Albert Hall tonight. The Prommers are the heroes, the true heroes of this wrong cycle, this year, of this Ring cycle, even this year. Our reporter, Georgia Mann, caught up with some of them in the queue this afternoon.
So I'm descending down the steps that are opposite the Royal College of Music with the hall just behind me. I have to say, I have spied a man with his top off, and that's not the only reason that I want to go and speak to him. It's because he and his friends have set themselves up in a sort of picnic circle here. Ladies and gents, hello, well, we're from Radio 3. Do you mind if we ask about your queuing experience today, and indeed what's drawn you here for the epic Die Walküre? Sir, tell us your name and where you're from, if you don't mind.
I'm called Sean, I'm from Edinburgh.
How long have you been sat here thus far?
Been here since midday, I think. Yeah.
And
yeah.
I see you've come prepared. You're kind of shedding items of clothing. Is the heat bothering you?
No, except we're sat next to a massive vent where all the air conditioning is coming out of, so it's not the best spot, really, but we've come this far, so it's fine.
Why have you decided to go all out to make sure that you're in there for Walküre this evening?
Well, we were kind of halfway back yesterday, and today we wanted to be really, really close for Britain Turfle.
I see, so it's a learning experience. You didn't quite get what you wanted to yesterday. This time you were making sure you would.
Yeah, we had to make sure we were prepared.
So is Bryn a big draw for you guys?
Yeah, definitely.
Bryn,
I mean, we saw the Ring cycle and him do Votan at Covent Garden just last year, and
what is it?
See it really close.
I mean, it's become almost a thing of legend in itself now, Bryn doing Wagner. But what for you does he bring to it?
I think he's an incredible actor. I mean, the humanity that he brings to the role, I think, is pretty special. Yeah.
I just have to ask your colleague, who I can see out the corner of my eyes here. So you've lost your top, I believe. How did that happen? How hot are you?
I'm exceptionally hot. We're from Scotland. We're not used to this kind of tropical heat.
But
it's adding
aren't.
Such a thing to the cycle. Last night, we sat in the heat, and then Donner hits his hammer, and we leave the place, and it's a tropical thunderstorm.
Yes.
You know, all through the night, and then back here today again. It's wonderful.
What is it about the music that speaks to you, though?
I mean, about Wagner?
Yes.
How can you say that in a soundbite?
You're just going to have to try.
It's the most wonderful, wonderful thing anyone, I think, can experience. It's in your head. It's physical. It feels like something's being done to you, like someone's touching you or something like that. But it's got the depth of the most, you know, fantastic idea. It's the best action story that you'll ever read. But at the same time, as I think the most important philosophy behind it.
This is the Proms. People are getting the chance to see this for £5. How big a deal is that to you?
I think that's the point of the ring. It's about people. This is the place to see Wagner, to stand outside in this, you know, tropical thunderstorms and heat, and then stand just a few metres from Brennan last night, that orchestra. It seems to be how it should be done.
This is my first ever opera experience live. I've only ever listened to Radio 3 or seen on BBC 4, The Proms. So, and this is incredible for me.
Some would say very brave to take Wagner on as your first experience and perhaps not a more manageable Mozart. I mean, what are you anticipating? Because obviously you've got a friend here who is an incredible advocate for it as an experience. What do you imagine is in store for you?
This is what I've been really enjoying. I mean, I met these guys yesterday in the queue.
Communities forming in the queue. That's what I like to hear.
I didn't really quite know what to expect, but yeah, I find I am kind of visualising it as I see it. I'm sort of following the libretto, and it's really great seeing it without the kind of the set design. As much as I'm interested by that, it's a different kind of experience.
Slightly purer experience, purer. Almost. What about the intricacies of the plot? Because I have to admit, I keep on trying to read them again and again and again to try and wedge it all into my brain. Did you find last night confusing to follow?
No, not at all. I didn't do too much preparation before I started.
Good.
But, you know, I'd seen a few things like Pappano's introduction to the Ring Cycle, which was fantastic and got me really excited. And that was what I thought, right, yeah, I'm going to come see this.
So we will be back for the next two instalments for the rest of the Ring Cycle.
Hell yeah. Can't wait.
Georgia Mann with some of the heroic Prommers who are here tonight. You know, that is an absolute realization of Wagner's original idea for who and how the ring was going to transform the world. It was going to be a folks opera. It was going to be for the people. Bayreuth, the Bayreuth Festival, his theatre, was originally going to be a place that was going to be cheap enough for the whole of his idealised Germany to come to. It was going to be an opera, a myth that would become of the people, of community. Exactly what's happening there in the Proms queue and indeed in the arena in front of me. And for £5 every night, they are getting the most sensational musical, mythical and dramatic experience. And they're making it happen. That's the point about what's happening at the Royal Albert Hall with this Ring Cycle this week. Georgia will be back with more from the queue and the Prommers experience on Friday and Sunday in the two final instalments, Siegfried and Goethe Dämmerung. So, in the third act of Die Walküre, we're going to hear a near continuous outpouring of some of the most visionary music that Wagner ever wrote, and therefore that's ever been written. There's glowing, compassionate radiance of the magic fire music as Wotan consigns Brunhilde to her fiery mountaintop, and the ride of the Valkyries that the third act opens with. This is truly magnificent music, whose power is inescapable. It's almost dangerously seductive, even manipulative, just as one of the Prommers was saying there. Daniel Barenboim agrees.
First of all, you have to say that each opera has its very different character. If I may paraphrase it, in many ways, Siegfried is Berlioz. The Goethe Dämmerung is almost Bruckner. You know what I mean? And then Rheingold, of course, is a conversation piece. This is what is so extraordinary. And therefore, you see the going from one to the other. And I think he was such a manipulator, Wagner. I think this is also one of the reasons why some people really cannot stand him. Because you feel manipulated. You feel manipulated by the music, you feel manipulated by the harmonies, you feel manipulated by the emotional context, as if he was perfectly aware, which he was, I'm sure, of the effect of every little thing that he wrote down. And the instrumentation is also perfectly controlled and manipulated, you know. I think it was Pierre Boulez who said, with Wagner, the orchestrator, you feel like he's doing a wonderful hamburger, and you have, you know, 50 grams of beef, and then you have 30 grams of veal, and then you have, I don't know, what, 20 grams of pork, and all mashed together. And that's what he does. He puts from all the instruments together, which are not meant, or were not until he came meant to be together. Very often you have trumpet and English horn playing in unison, which then Debussy, of course, did so much of that with in La Mer already and all that. But all kinds of combinations like this. And I think he was very conscious of the effect every one of those tricks, if you want.
Daniel Barenboim, well, central to the drama of the third act is the relationship between Wotan and his favourite daughter, Brunhilde. Because of her disobedience, Wotan banishes her to suspended animation, asleep on a mountaintop. But he surrounds her with fire that only a hero can penetrate. No mere mortal will get to claim Brunhilde. Bryn Terfel tells us Wotan's side of the story in a minute, but first, here's Nina Stemmer. How does she see the relationship with her god-leading father?
When I look at the relationship Brynhilde-Wotan, I see it on different levels. I see it on the mythical level between the head of gods, Wotan, and his favorite daughter, which he actually wished to come, and she came. And also the word Wunsch in German also has to do with desire. So it's also a Freudian relationship in some to some extent, but I like to take these characters down to earth to bring out the real person in them and the human side. And you can also see this relationship as one between a father and his teenage daughter who wants to break free and also has to pay the consequences and also gains quite a bit. And also, actually, in the final scene of Valkyrie, I think it's not really outspoken, but Brynhilde realizes that she has to take over after Wotan and actually fulfill his will, which she won't be able to do until the very end of Götterdämmerung.
Tonight's Brynhilde, and indeed the Brynhilde on Friday and Sunday, to Nina Stemmer. So what about Wotan? Bryn Terfel.
It's like he said about Siegmund, it's the best time that I've ever spent with him, you know, roaming through the forests. And I think he had the same kind of relationship with Brynhilde as well. Yes, it's his favourite daughter. He relays everything to her. There's a wink, there's a twinkle in the eye. I can't say from a father's perspective, because I've only got three boys, but I can say to you what it's like to be, of course, a father to three wonderful children. And sometimes, of course, they, like her, don't listen to me. So, but they have to find there's consequences to that as well.
Bryn Terfel. So, Act 3 of Die Walküre. We hear first the Ride of the Valkyries, who've assembled to compare the dead heroes they've harvested for Valhalla. Their sister Brunhilde arrives, though, shockingly, with a living woman, Sieglinde, who's pregnant with her son by Siegmund, a hero that Brunhilde names Siegfried. Wotan arrives on the mountain summit, where all of the Valkyries are, to deliver his judgment on his beloved daughter, Brunhilde, who dared to defy him. She's going to be put into a magic slumber here on the mountain. But Brunhilde, not surprisingly, complains. After all, she rightly says, she was only doing Wotan's true will in trying to save Siegmund. So instead of leaving her prey to any old bloke who might come along and be able to see her on the mountaintop there, Wotan summons the god Loga, the god of fire, to encircle her in a ring of fire, fit for a hero to conquer. And at that moment, we hear Siegfried's music in the orchestra, prophetic perhaps that maybe it will be Brunhilde's heroic nephew, Siegfried, who will be her savior. This is a sound world of deep and sensual beauty that the music that the opera ends with, that Die Walküre ends with, the magic fire music that ends the piece. The singers you hear in Act 3 of Die Walküre here at the Royal Albert Hall. The Valkyries are Simona Schröder, Anna Lapkowskaja, Leanne Sandel-Pantaleo, Susan Foster, Anna Eek-Morel, Ivona Fuchs, Carola Hearn, and Sonja Mulek. Their sister, Brunhilde, is sung by Nina Stemmer, and Bryn Terfel is their father, Wotan. And no less theatrically, no less at the centre of this drama, and really the catalyst through which the whole thing is happening, Daniel Barenboim conducts the Staatskapelle Berlin, who are tuning in front of me. You know, the scale of the Ring cycle can be daunting or challenging in a way. Sarah Moore-Peach has been telling us as a first-time Ring listener, but really the thing that I'm astonished by watching Daniel Barenboim with this orchestra is the chamber-like sound world that he's able to get for the drama between these characters. Remember how this opera started? Just three singers on stage, Siegmund, Sieglinde, and Hunding. And actually what Wagner does is bring the sound world right down, a solo cello at times, solo instruments, and one of the wonderful solos for bass clarinet or bass trumpet, that peculiar instrument that's so much the center of Die Walküre's sound world. And that's what Daniel Barenboim is doing so much, asking the orchestra to play down so that we can hear every word, every moment of the drama communicates to the Royal Albert Hall. And here he comes on stage, bringing the members of the Staatskapelle Berlin to their feet and accepting applause on this humid but miraculous evening here at the Royal Albert Hall. Magic fire, well, there's magic humidity in the hall here tonight. Daniel Barenboim giving more acclaim to his players and receiving it too from this full house and the promise there. Act three then of Wagner's Die Walküre.
Thank you. Thank you. Verworfenen, wir sie warf. Zu ziehen, schuf ich die Herzen euch hart und scharf, dass der Wilde nun weint und greint, wenn mein Krimmer eine treulose straft. So wisst denn, Winsende, was die verbrach, um die euch zagen, die Zähre entbrennt. Keiner wie sie kannte mein innerstes Sinnen. Keiner wie sie wusste den Quell meines Willens. Des Wunsches schaffende Schoß. Und so nun brach sie den seligen Bund, das treulos sie meinem Willen getrotzt, mein herrschend Gebot, offen verhängt, gegen mich die Waffe gewandt, die mein Wunsch allein ihr schuf. Helm und Wehr, Wanne und Huld, Name und Leben verlieh. Hörst du mich klagen, erheben, und birgst dich band im Kläge, das feig du der Straf entflößt.
Die Strafe.
Ich straf ich dich erst, deine Strafe schufst du dir selbst. Durch meinen Willen warst du allein, gegen mich doch hast du gewollt. Meinen Befehl nur führtest du aus, gegen mich doch hast du befohlen. Unschmeid warst du mir, gegen mich doch hast du gewünscht. Schildmeid warst du mir, gegen mich doch hobst du den Schild. Großkriegerin warst du mir, gegen mich doch kiestest du lose. Heldenreizerin warst du mir, gegen mich doch leitest du Hell.
Thank you. Meidet jagst in Felsen, hurtig jagt mir von innen, sonst erhart die Anneuche hier.
Oh. zu fechten.
So hieß es um mich, als Herrscher der Wagner.
Doch meine Weisung nahm ich wieder zurück.
Als Freier den eigenen Sinn dir entfremdet, da ihrem Sinn du dich fürchtest, warst du selber dir feind.
Wend ich und strafte den wissenden Trotz. Doch feig und dumm dachtest du mich, so hätt ich Verrat nicht zu rächen, so gering wärst du meinem Grimm. Dennoch den Schutz.
Heil für dich, heil für dich.
Und musst
zu tun ich begehrt. Ach, was nicht zu tun, die Not zwiefach mich zwang. So leicht brennt es nur von des Herzens erwarmen, wo brennend wie das Herz mir brach, wo grässliche Not den Grimm mir schuf, eine Welt zu Liebe, der Liebe Kamel, im gequälten Herzen zu hemmen. O gegen mich selber, ich sehnt mich wand, auf Ohnmacht schmerzen, schäumt mich Aufschluss. Sehnsucht, sendender Wunsch, den schrecklichen Werden mir schuf, in den Flügel der eigenen Welt. Den Leiden von mir sagtest du dich los. Ich muss meiden, gemeinsam mit dir, nicht darf ich Not mehr raunen. Getrennt, ich dürfe traut wie mir schaffen, so weit Leben und Luft.
Oh, my God. zu stören, erwarte dein Los, wie sich's dir wirft, nicht gießen kann ich es dir. Doch fort muss ich jetzt fern mich verziehen, zu viele schon zögert ich hier, von der Abwendigen wend ich mich ab, nicht wissen darf ich, was sie sich wünscht, die Strafe nur muss vollstreckt ich sehen.
Was hast du gedacht, dass ich hätte?
Yeah.
Lust ein Kuss dir lohnte, wenn kindisch lallend der Heldenlob von holden Lippen dir floss. Diese Augen strahlen des
Herz mir senke, nach Welten wann ein Wunsch verlangte, aus Welt jemandem Thank you.
Music of magic fire the end of Wagner's Die Walküre here at the Proms. Daniel Barenboim conducted the Staatskapelle Berlin. Grünthäuvel was Wotan, bidding the saddest, fondest, most loving and most radiant farewell to his daughter, Brunhilde, sung tonight by Nina Stemmer. Daniel Barenboim and his orchestra, the Staatskapelle Berlin, on their feet, turn to the Royal Albert Hall audience. The Valkyries you heard at the start of Act 3 were Simona Schroeder, Anna Lapkovskaya, Leanne Sandel-Pantaleo, Susan Foster, Annette Morel, Ivona Fuchs, Carola Hearn, and Sonja Mulek. Daniel Barenboim leading the applause for his musicians of the Staatskapelle Berlin. Magic fire, it's just about the best possible metaphor for the music making we've experienced tonight, and indeed last night, and that's to come in Friday's Siegfried and Sunday's Die Götterdämmerung, the end of Wagner's Ring Cycle on Sunday. In the first edition of Proms Extra on Saturday night on BBC Two, you can hear a feature, you can watch a feature about Barenboim's Ring Cycle, including an interview with Daniel Barenboim. The cast of the whole of Die Walküre coming on stage. Siegmund, Sieglinde, Hunding, Fricke, and Grünthäuvel as Wotan at their centre, with Nina Stemmer just in front of the conductor's podium. Listen to this roar as they walk to the front of the stage. The most magnificent, passionate, fiery tribute to this performance of Die Walküre that the Royal Albert Hall has witnessed tonight. The story continues then on Friday, but there are more proms in between. Tomorrow night here at the Royal Albert Hall, the BBC National Orchestra of Wales and cellist Raphael Valfish play Bantok's Sapphic Poem, and Jack Van Steen conducts Elgar, Walton and Tchaikovsky. All that tomorrow at 7:30 at the proms. But as Grünthäuvel leads the cast off to applause and tumultuous adoration, really, that's going to go on here, I'm sure, for minutes. It's time to hand you back in the thrall of this atmosphere to Broadcasting House and Ian Skelly.
Tom, thank you very much indeed. Tom Service at the Royal Albert Hall for tonight's BBC Prom. And don't forget that you can hear that performance again if you'd like to, anytime over the next 7 days. It's there on the iPlayer Radio, which you'll find on the Radio 3 website. So yes, a pause for a day or so before we return to Siegfried on Friday afternoon at 5. And then, rather as Wagner did, we shall pause again, leaving Siegfried. I think Wagner said he put him under a linden tree for a while, 27 years in all. We'll wait, though, as Tom was saying, until Sunday to hear an opera in the meantime that he composed in between his two bits on the ring. Tristan und Isolde. That performance is given by the BBC Symphony Orchestra and Chorus and conducted by Simeon Bitchkov. Peter Seifert and Violetta Urmana sing the title roles in that performance. You can hear it live here on BBC Radio 3 from 5 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. And then, as Tom was saying, it's Sunday afternoon for the big climax, Götterdämmerung. That begins at 4:30 on Sunday. And there is plenty of background to The Ring on the Radio 3 website, including our opera guides to all of the operas by the three birthday boys this year, Wagner, Verdi and Britten. Everything you need to know about each of their operas. We're broadcasting each and every one of them during the course of the year, and our guides give you all you need to know in a handy 8 minutes or so. You'll find the guides to each episode of The Ring on the event pages of the BBC Proms website. What is it? 10:03 now. The Proms is not the only festival we're celebrating this week. Here's Mary Ann Kennedy.
Join us each night this week at 11 for highlights from the Late Junction stage at the 2013 Latitude Festival. Composer Anna Meredith crosses the boundary between concert hall and festival stage. Multi-instrumentalist Nancy Elizabeth conjures up old English folk traditions, and the electronic duo Walls dig deep into the archives of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop. And on Friday at 11, we begin a weekend of broadcasts from that leading festival of world music, WOMAD 2013. Latitude and WOMAD 2013, BBC Radio 3 at two of the UK's most diverse music festivals. Join us each night this week.
Well, at 10:15, before the first of those programmes, the broadcaster Andrew Marr is amongst the guests on a discussion that took place at this year's Radio 3 Free Thinking Festival in Gateshead. The subject was world history and the thorny question of rewriting it. That's all at 10:15 tonight. Music to begin to take us to that point by one of the composers in tomorrow night's prom, Maurice Ravel. This is his portrait of a boat sailing on the sea. It's played by Anna Vinitskaya.
Thank you.
Unbach sur l'Océan by Ravel, Anna Vinitskaya playing it. Well, there's a little time to go before Free Thinking on Radio 3 tonight, so let's return from French waters to English landscapes and one of Gerald Finn's eloquent bagatelles for piano and clarinet. Clarinetist John Bradbury and the pianist James Cryer playing one of five bagatelles by Gerald Finzi. You're listening to BBC Radio 3. Well, it's now time to hear a debate from last year's Radio 3 Free Thinking Festival of Ideas, which took place at the Sage Gateshead. Tonight's discussion focuses on rewriting world history with Andrew Marr, Anthony Beaver and Maria Misra. The event is hosted by Rana Mitter.
As we all know, Persia is full of giant ants who dig gold out of the ground. Well, at least that's true if you believe one of the earliest histories of the world by the ancient Greek historian Herodotus. In other words, human beings have been rewriting the history of the world for quite a long while now. But today, at a time when global power seems to be shifting from the North Atlantic to the Pacific, we need to think about whether